You're listening to the OCD Stories podcast, hosted by me, Stuart Ralph. The OCD Stories is a podcast dedicated to raising awareness and understanding around obsessive compulsive symptoms. I do this through interviewing inspired therapists, psychologists, and people who have experienced OCD. Welcome to the OCD Stories. And welcome to episode 335. And in this one, Tracy has kindly agreed to share her story with us. And in it, we discuss misophonia, perfectionism, religious scrupulosity, starting with therapy, ADHD, sexual intrusive thoughts, unwanted arousal, groinal, needing to get therapy perfect, rumination, and so much more. And thank you to NoCD for supporting the podcast. NoCD offers affordable, effective, and convenient therapy available in the US and outside the US. To find out more about NoCD, their therapy plans, if they currently take your insurance, or to download their free app, head over to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories, or the link will be in the episode description. So thank you to Tracy for her time. I appreciate it. And of course, thank you to you guys for your time. I appreciate you listening. And without further ado, here she is. Welcome to the podcast, Tracy.
Thank you. It's very good to be here. I feel a little starstruck right now, but...
Thank you.
I've been a listener, not ever been a participant, so this is cool.
Nice. Well, it's good to have you on. I'm looking forward to hearing your story. So, you know, as you know, I'd like to hear your story, and you can go into as little or as much detail as you want to.
Okay. I thought about this a lot and what I want to share, and I do want to share the last 2 years, because you know they it's where I've really discovered a lot about my OCD and have had a lot of different experiences. But I do want to just, you know, hash out real quickly. I'm like most people who knew they had OCD as a child. My OCD as a child, I was really funny about textures and weird things touching my skin, the way my shoes were tied, smells, noises. I still have a big problem with people chewing gum and smacking and stuff. So I have that misophonia thing. And as a child, I was just terrified by all that stuff. You know, I hated being around anything that made me uncomfortable or made me feel weird. And I remember that had a lot of worries over my mom. She had suffered from severe depression, and I remember that really bothering me. As a teenager, I chose to do a book report about multiple personalities. That was the first time I ever really remember OCD happening. I didn't know what it was, but it was like, well, could I have multiple personalities? Oh my God, am I somebody else right now? And it just went down a spiral. I never understood why these things went away, but they would just be episodic and go away. But they were terrifying when they were happening. And I had postpartum OCD after my first son. And I will say I got married at age 16. I had my first son at age 17. I married, you know, his father. I had another child at age 19. So I pretty rapidly progressed as a young girl into a mother, wife, and all of that. So I was a young girl, you know, had postpartum OCD about harm at that point, and that was very terrifying. I kind of had a sense that I just didn't need to be a stay-at-home mom, which made me feel terribly guilty, but I was able to get beyond it through just getting into cosmetology school. I put my dreams off of being a nurse. I had to, you know, quit high school, and I, you know, decided to become a hairdresser. So I did that. And then fast forward to, like, I'm in my early 20s. I suffer from perfectionism. So, and it really hits me with, like, body image, my appearance, my work. I'm competitive at work. I wanted to be the best hairdresser ever. I wanted, you know, if I exercise, I've got to really do it perfect and do it, you know, if once or twice a week is good, then 7 days a week is what I'll do. You know, I've injured my body a lot over the years by doing that. But all I can do now is walk. But anyway, as a 20-something-year-old girl, I was quite cocky and arrogant. I look back on that and I felt like I had the picture perfect life. I mean, I had a husband who was a fireman, and I had pushed him to work his way up, and I was a successful hairdresser. We had built our own home. I couldn't have been more than 22 or 23, had two beautiful boys. And yet I had a very big stressor in my life going in. I had a family member who was very close to me that was causing me a lot of stress. And it was someone I loved very much and very dearly. And I didn't know how to address it with this person. And I still struggle with that, you know, of really confronting people that I care about, you know, something they're doing that's bothering me. And this was pretty disruptive. And I just remember, you know, it causing a lot of anxiety and I'm being very upset because I thought my life is perfect. My life is great. Why is this happening? You know, wish this would stop. I wish I didn't feel this way. And I was spiraling out of control with my eating. Kind of, I was disordered eating. I wouldn't say I was full blown anorexic, but I was really restricting calories and really exercising a lot. And at that time, I had a young body, so I could run 5 miles in it. You know, I had no back pain or anything, and so there was no limits to that. And so, you know, I kind of knew I was probably taking that out of hand, and that kind of bothered me because the central kind of theme to my OCD is I just don't want anything to be wrong with me. And people were noticing I might be anorexic and all that. But anyway, I saw a Forensic Files. I love true crime. I was watching that and saw a disturbing photo. And the photo wouldn't leave my brain. I just remember it wouldn't leave my brain. I was like, oh, my God, why won't this go away? And it was very distressing. And I was just going to start a new workout routine the next morning. I used to be very, very, very into fitness. Like I said, I've injured myself a lot over the years. I was starting a new gym, going in. It was going to wake up at 4 a.m. I don't know about anybody, but waking up at 4 a.m. here, it's dark outside and it's creepy. But I had this image in my head that was stuck and it was frightening. And I knew it felt like this thing that had happened to me in the past, which I didn't know was OCD, but I just knew I was feeling it again. And it started quickly into harm obsessions towards my children. And these my two boys were everything in my life. I mean, starting out as such a young mother and being so passionate about wanting to be a good mom and, you know, having all the odds stacked against me because, you know, teenage moms, are they really supposed to be successful or, you know, but I'm, with my personality, it's like, no, you know, I'm going to be the best mom ever. So having this OCD or starting to have these thoughts and not understanding what was happening was it was like my whole perfect world went down the toilet. And that was very traumatic. And I didn't understand what was happening. And what happened at that time in my life was religious scrupulosity became the primary, really ended up being the primary thing. You don't recognize it when it's happening because I'm using this religious scrupulosity to protect myself so that I'm a perfect Christian and I would never do these things going through my mind. I live in the Bible Belt of the South in Alabama. So, you know, Christianity and faith is huge in these parts of the country, especially in the United States. Very conservative, you know, state I live in. And so I was no stranger to, you know, to God and praying and the Bible and faith. So I immediately, that was my inclination. I turned to God. I turned to scripture. And I wanted to read something in the Bible that would give me the assurance I would never do these things. I searched and searched and searched. And also trying to become a perfect Christian. You know, that was my other, you know, protective. It felt like, oh, I've got to be perfect, morally perfect, to ward off this, you know, this kind of character indictment thing of these feelings of feeling like a bad person. So, you know, that got out of control really quickly because there, you know, the Bible doesn't ever give any absolutes, right? I mean, it's, you know, lean not on your own understanding, but in all your ways, acknowledge me, cast, pray to God, you know, well, it says pray, you know, if you want this mountain moved it, and it shall be moved. And I know that very confusing for a lot of Christians, but it's like, I couldn't get the faith right. And that was why I wasn't getting better because I wasn't. The faith I had was not enough. So anyway, that was a very hard time. I lost a lot of weight. You know, people already thought I had an eating disorder and I was really losing weight because of the OCD and it just became, you know, awful. But everybody thought my religious scrupulosity was great. I worked around a lot of Christians. They're like, oh, she's turning her life over to God. This is, you know, this is great. This is what she's needed. So nobody saw that as a bad thing. It was all compulsive. I did see a therapist and, you know, his approach to therapy was, you know, he didn't tell me I had OCD. I don't know that he knew I had OCD. He just knew that I was having these thoughts that I didn't want to be having. And he wanted to make sure that I acknowledged the thought in some way, that I wasn't trying to say it didn't happen or ignore it. And because of my perfectionism and need to get, you know, therapy right, which I will definitely get into, I didn't realize that at the time. I never understood, like, or I felt like I actually got what he was saying correct. It was like, okay, you want me to acknowledge it? Well, I did that. I said, hey, thought, like you told me to do, but the thought didn't go away. Still there. And I don't feel good. And I don't know what else I'm supposed to do after that. Well, you just move on with your day. You just go on. Well, I'm doing that too, but the thought still comes back. So, you know, so it was, it just never felt right. And then I thought, do I have to keep acknowledging it? Because I will acknowledge it 1,000 times a day. Like, at what point is one, do I do it 5 times a day? I was getting worse with this therapy. I mean, I was not getting any better. And I wished the therapist at the time, had just recognized that, you know, but, and referred me on or something, but he didn't. And I ended up finding a Christian therapist because I decided, well, I need to go to a Christian therapist. I got really lucky. The Christian therapist immediately said, well, you're a perfectionist. And I went, no, do not tell me that. I do not want anything to be wrong with me. And he was like, no, you're seriously a perfectionist. I need more information, but I can tell you that's going on, you know, with the moral scrupulosity thing. And a few more sessions in, he said, you have OCD. And I've never felt more relief in my whole life while at the same time let down, if that makes sense. It's like, and I've heard other people talk about it. It's like, I heard the exact thing that I was so terrified of, is that something was wrong, right? Something wrong with me. But it was so relieving. He told me to read Brain Lock by Jeffrey Schwartz. And I do believe Brain Lock is a fundamental OCD book. Do I believe in the, you know, all the 4 steps and all that? It's mainly a book towards physical compulsions, not even mental compulsions, which is what I really had. But it was fundamental, and I resonated with it. And it all I can say is, at that time in my life, it's what I needed to hear. I got on a lot of Prozac, and that helped. Kind of spiraled me the other way. I ended up gaining a lot of weight on the Prozac, but I didn't care. I mean, Prozac made me not care about anything. My house became a mess. My whole life became a disaster. I didn't care about OCD. I mean, my husband, why I say that, I was so focused on my OCD. My husband was suffering from addiction. I didn't realize it. A lot of problems were happening. And I was so deep in my own head. So I was, you know, the OCD went away like it always does. I can't, you know, yeah, I was on medicine. Yeah. You know, I was doing the 4 steps and Brain Lock, and this was in 1998. I think that was, you know, the International OCD Foundation, when it was in its infancy. I remember I had just got the internet at that point and actually became a member, and they would mail you newsletters in the mail. I still have those newsletters, but, yeah, it was pretty cool, but, nostalgic, but, anyway, life went on, and my husband, you know, then suffering from addiction, that took its own toll on my life. And I did have a relapse several years after that with confession. That's bad. I mean, that was the first time I'd ever had a real compulsion, a tangible, concrete compulsion. So anyway, that was horrible. That was awful. I decided to medicate the OCD out of me at that point. So I was on a bunch of different medications, went to multiple psychiatrists who each one diagnosed me with having either bipolar. I do have ADHD, and, you know, got treated for that. But they were all trying to treat something else beside the OCD because they felt like, well, these other things are a problem. We need to treat them too. I was on antipsychotics, anti-anxiety, SSRIs, SNRIs mixed in with the SSRIs, you name it. I had a pill box. I work in geriatrics now as a nurse practitioner, and I had way more pills than my geriatric patients did at age, you know, 30 something or 29, however old I was. But it was awful. I mean, all the side effects of that medicine, and none of that medicine ever really to me did anything without, you know, because I wasn't doing any response bridging. I was doing no, you know, nothing like that. We were just trying to medicate it out. But I finally realized my husband was pretty sick. He got incarcerated. Anyway, that was happening. And I pretty much had a little bit too much to focus on, and the OCD took a backseat again. I had to get on with my life, pick me and my boys up, get us moved, get us safe. It was a lot. And I just quit thinking about the OCD. It just disappeared like it, you know, always had. You know, I went to nursing school at that time, really, you know, and became the perfect student. I was going to, you know, be a, you know, I was going to graduate summa cum laude if it killed me. And I did. And I met my husband. I'm married to now. And he's a great guy. And I can say he's as perfect as they get. Life was going great. But, you know, as an OCD kind of personality trait, you know, as long as I had something to really work on, like school and then a new career, then I went to graduate school. You know, that kept me busy and preoccupied. I'm sure the OCD was somewhere underneath all the layers.
Yeah. It,
we know that, right? I mean, anytime we've had relapses, it's like, well, I've had these kind of thoughts before. They just usually didn't bother me. But the latest relapse happened in 2020. It was before the pandemic. Everybody was hearing about COVID. I do not have germ OCD or anything like that. I do not have, you know, I stuff like that does not bother me. So I wasn't worried about COVID, but I was worried about my oldest son who was suffering from severe depression and addiction as well. And that was pretty bad. I was not working because I worked for the federal government for a VA hospital in Birmingham, and it takes a long time to get employed by the United States government here. And so I wasn't working, and I kind of knew that probably wasn't good for me. And it was kind of scary. Idle time is not something I do well with. I'm trying to do better with it now, but it was certainly hard. I remember I did the whole 30 diet and took that to an unhealthy level, but my son had to move in with us. And, you know, that was hard because I didn't know how that was going to affect my marriage. You know, I had married this guy when my sons were in their 20s, and I'm 48 now. You know, I had kids before I was 20. So we all kind of grew up together. So I was probably at the time when he and I got married, you know, I was about 42, but the boys were in their 20s. So now I've been at this time 6 years with my husband, and we've never had children in the house. He doesn't have kids. And so it was just scary. And I can tell you what happened. The theme that emerged was sexually based intrusive thoughts. I can tell you, I knew I'd had thoughts like this a lot, that for whatever reason, I was just so preoccupied. I mean, we all have them. I mean, these are just thoughts everybody experiences. The difference is when you're relapsed with OCD, suddenly there's a big problem with that thought, you know, and why did I think it? And for me, how can I make it stop and how can I make it go away? When I relapsed this past time, I knew that I did not need to try to prove that I wasn't the sexual monster. Because my thoughts, it could be about anybody, any person, anything, anything that was ego dystonic to me, you know, that I shouldn't be having thoughts like that toward. And images were a big problem, having lots of, you know, I think most OCDers with, you know, harm and sexual based thoughts are really anything that, you know, the visual imagery is just so distressing. So I, you know, was dealing with that. And where was I? What was I talking about? I relapsed with that, trying to understand that. And I remember, oh, I know what I was trying to say. I didn't want to try to disprove it because I knew that was compulsive. So I was like, okay, I can't do like I did with harm. I knew it was OCD. This time I knew it was OCD. That's what made this so different for me. It's like, I went back to the Jeffrey Swartz 4 steps. I went back to that. But I mean, I thought, these aren't going away. Why is this hanging around like this? And I started developing a lot of resentment and anger, which at the time I didn't realize was compulsive. I later on realized it was, but it felt very protective to, you know, really rebuke and get upset. I also did a lot of internal straining and wincing and like thought blocking, you know, to it felt protective. It felt like I don't want to be thinking this. So if I push really hard and strain really hard, maybe these thoughts won't bleed in. The bodily sensations that go along with sexually based thoughts are very distressing. And I think, and I still deal with this till this day. It's kind of tensing up for a minute, you know, because I don't want to feel that. So that was kind of what was happening. But I finally decided, okay, I got to get a hold of this. Let me search the internet. There's no telling what's all out there now. Well, lo and behold, there's a lot of OCD, you know, stuff, a lot more than there was in 1998 and in 2002 or three when I had another relapse. But I found a book, and many people on your show have read it. And if you Google search or Amazon search books about how to get rid of intrusive thoughts, you're going to find this book. And it's a great book, great book. The only part of this book that I don't agree with is the part where they have you in expose yourself to your unwanted thoughts, you know, do exposures, you know, on your own. That was something I had been very resistant to. I knew that ERP existed years ago. And I refused. I always told anybody, I will not do that. Like, not going to do that. Don't even ask me to do that. And so at this point in my life, I was confronted with, maybe I've got to do this thing to get better. And so I did, and I decided I would do this. And I get in my car and I live in Tuscaloosa County, but I work in Birmingham. So there's an hour drive, and I thought, well, I'll do it on my way to work. And so I'm driving, and I start doing this. I start exposing myself. And what was really weird is it was not as scary as I thought. I mean, like, when I'm bringing these thoughts on, and I learned a lot more about this later for my personality, it felt more in control. And I'm like, huh, well, maybe I need to make it scarier. You know, maybe I'm not doing it exactly right. Maybe so I would try to keep making it scarier. At this point, something happened that really, really sent me over the edge, that really was traumatic, was I suddenly started feeling very, very intense arousal. I was not trying. Obviously, I went into this. That was not the goal. I never even knew this could happen. Mm. I didn't. And I feel stupid because I'm a medical professional, and it's like, did I not think that this was going to I had no clue that could happen. And that was terrifying. It was terrifying, and it was horrible. And I just wish I had known. I just wish there had been some warning shot. Hey, if you got sexually based intrusive thoughts and you start, you know, bringing up these images and, you know, vignettes of whatever, your body's going to have a response to that. Right. I mean, yeah, that's natural. That's normal. And on some level I knew that, but it wasn't enough to satisfy me. And I wanted the arousal to go away. I wanted it gone. Like, I just want this gone. And I even had thoughts like, well, do I do something about this? And then I thought, God, why did I think that? You know, I just want it out of this very vulnerable feeling I was feeling. Cause I thought, what if the orgasm just happens? You know, what if I spontaneously do this? And then, you know, so a part of me kept thinking, do I control this and do this on my, and I thought, you know, that'd be sick. And so anyway, I had a very distressing moment. I ended up being able to go to work, which for me is like, okay, if I don't go to work, what is that going to say about me? But I was very distressed. And at the time, the pandemic was going on and we weren't real busy at work. I worked with end of life and palliative care. And at the time, yes, there were a lot of people passing away from COVID, but they were keeping those patients contained in the ICUs. And so really I was new at the job. And so we were not busy. And that was also not good for me because I went to work and had a lot of idle time to just stew and obsess over what had happened.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And so from that point, I started researching what did happen and ran up on some literature about arousal non-concordance. And what you learn about in that, and I am in no way comparing myself to sexual assault victims and victims of sexual abuse, but that can happen with those victims. They can achieve orgasm, they can become very aroused, they can remember it feeling good. And that's very distressing for them, of course. And I could relate only in that again, to my knowledge, I have never, you know, been sexually abused or been a victim of sexual assault in that way. And but I know that what it feels like, I can imagine what these people are going through because this was really distressing for me, you know. But to know it had a name and that your body does that was relieving. I then did some more search. I thought, okay, that wasn't enough. How much more can I find out? And I found Chrissy Hodges. And, you know, I found this girl with the, like Chance Neely describes her, with the big blonde hair talking about groinals, you know. And I thought, oh, man, wow. You know, and she's got a Southern accent like me. So I, you know, really related to her. So listened to many of her videos and decided I must reach out to her. I got to reach out to her. So I did. and we talked, and she gave me a lot of great resources and names of therapists. And she was like, you gotta get real treatment for this through a trained therapist. And so I was willing to do that. And I reached out to one, and of course the wait list for people are very long. So I was put on like a wait list, and I had no idea. They said it could be as long as 6 months, and it ended up being about that long. During that time, I was doing a lot of my own research in ACT, research in CBT, ERP, you know, but really ACT, I bought Stephen Hayes's book and, you know, started really trying to perfect that. And this is something I can speak to now, but I didn't really realize my need to get the therapy so perfect. And so no amount of anything I read, all it turned into was another compulsion. It would just be another compulsion. So I realized I was getting sicker and sicker and not better, but I was waiting on therapy. And then you had Dr. Greenberg on, you know, and that was pretty life-changing for me. I was one of the people that I pulled my car over and cried after listening to him, because I was like, oh my God, thank God, you know, all this meditation and mindfulness and ACT, and, you know, I know now why it didn't work. I'm not discrediting. Those therapies are useful and they are beneficial. And I believe in, but in that moment, they had not helped me for reasons I understand now, but I just resonated with Dr. Michael Greenberg, and I became obsessed, for lack of a better word, with him. And I listened to him on Game Changers. I know they had him on because when you had that debut, I think that for a lot of us who resonated with him, that was a pretty huge day. Somebody finally put a name to this, and that there is compulsive rumination, and there is, you know, there is a way to stop it. And you know, just everything that just bringing yourself back to the present moment is not going to make you stop ruminating. And yes, I guess you can mindfully be ruminating if you're not watching it, which, you know, like for ACT, if I'm doing any value-based action, I'm going to be ruminating the whole time. So I never quite understood how to apply that in that particular way. But anyway, so I really studied up on him, waiting to see my therapist that was going to do a new ERP. I finally got in to see that therapist, and he did try ERP. And he did the IR, you know, the RP or whatever. And we went through that. Now I think it's what's common, and I don't understand it because I don't think it's as helpful as prolonged exposures, but bring it up 10 times a day, you know, bring the thought up just for a minute, you know, whatever. He never gave me real good explicit instructions. So of course I'm like, well, did I do it right? I mean, did he want me to bring it up for 5 seconds, 10 seconds, 1 minute? What do I do? Do I just do it? Well, oh God, I just ripped it apart. So, okay. So he'd have to make sure I understood the instructions exactly. And this went on, and I didn't get any better. If anything, I felt like I was getting worse, you know, I was just getting worse. And, you know, cause I just kept worrying that I wasn't doing it right. And it kept me very engaged. And then to a certain weird degree, I liked being able to expose myself because I knew I was in control. It was something, it felt better for me to bring it up than for my brain to bring this to me spontaneously. So in a way it started becoming compulsive, which is something that just everything always turns into compulsion for me. So with this therapist, I had another family stressful event happening that he developed a curiosity about and ended up helping me with that. I told him I was better, but I knew I wasn't. My husband even said, Tracy, you're worse than I've ever seen you, and you're spending a lot of money on this therapy. What has happened? So I got in with another therapist. I was already on a wait list at this point for someone else. So I started, this is an ACT therapist. And she immediately was like, well, you have obsessive compulsive personality disorder. Has anyone ever told you that? And I'm like, no. I said, I've been told I'm a perfectionist. And I said, I think that's a problem. And she said, well, yeah, but you miss, you know, I've had other therapists since then tell me they don't think I have the personality disorder. They think I'm a perfectionist. But she was a little concerned about how that was going to complicate treatment. I did the whole ACT worksheets. And we identified a lot of stuff. You know, I was spending a lot of time on the internet listening to your podcast, lots of other podcasts about OCD. I couldn't get enough information. I read lots of books, self-help. And she said, you know, are you going to let me help you? Are you going to really commit to what I'm trying to do and quit trying to fix yourself? And that sounded pretty terrifying. I'm like, I guess I hadn't thought about it, but that sounds frightening. But yeah, I'll do what you say, you know. And so I got off social media, I got rid of all those compulsions. I felt like we didn't really work on filling that void. I'm not somebody, the reason ACT is complicated for me is I'm not an avoider. I'm one of these people, this disease will not take my life. So I'm going to go on trips. I'm going to go to work. I'm going to spend time with my family. I'll be around any triggers. I'm not going to let this disease rob my life. And so that was kind of hard because I already engaged in all these value-based actions. Yes, I was spending a lot of time. So it was going to free up a lot of time, but I never filled that mental, you know, I just filled it up with more compulsions, mental compulsions. And so she recognized I was trying to perfect it. And she said, Tracy, anything I give you, you're just going to try to perfect it. I don't know what to tell you. And so we never tried to work on that theme because every therapist I go to, it's the sexual thoughts, the images. I'm trying to handle those because I think that's the biggest issue. She recognized this perfectionism and need to perfect therapy, but we never tried to center ERP around that. And I got on some heavy doses of Zoloft at the time. And I got to what I felt like was maybe as good as I was going to get. She said, Tracy, you're so functional. I mean, you go to work, you go on trips with your girlfriend. You know, you don't need therapy like this. You know, I think you're okay. And I'm like, okay. So I got out. And I do want to share this experience because I thought it was really helpful. I got back into Michael Greenberg stuff. I thought, okay, I've given up looking at his articles and rereading them over and over again, trying to get it just right what he was talking about. So I thought, well, let me go back and see. And he has you do exercises where you bring up the thought and, you know, ruminate for a few minutes and then don't ruminate. I tried that and I had never felt right. I never felt like I could get it right or for whatever reason, I thought it just didn't work. But I thought, I'm going to sit here tonight and I'm going to do this until I figure it out. What I discovered was every time I allowed rumination, okay, it's my time to ruminate. Felt kind of like, okay, well, what am I supposed to, my mind would wander and I'd be like, hey, I'm supposed to be ruminating. Let me try to bring this rumination on. Then when I wasn't supposed to ruminate, I was just real focused and real just almost stressing out, like straining. I did this enough times that it finally hit me that the rumination was when I was trying not to ruminate. That was when I was actually performing a compulsion. And it's kind of like, I know you had Elizabeth Forrester on that. She says, you know, if you tell yourself you can't think about red cars, then all you're all going to do is think about red cars all day. So I was really ruminating about ruminating. I was like, oh God, I can't do this rumination thing. So all I thought about all the time was rumination because I wasn't supposed to be doing it. So I'm trying to avoid it. So what I realized in that exercise was when I thought I wasn't supposed to be ruminating, I was pushing and blocking. I thought I had to like stop all thoughts. I still have trouble with thoughts coming in. Like when I'm trying to do ERP, they're just so bothersome because I want to figure out what the thought is and what the threat is. And so I realized I was doing that. And that was pretty, I think I broke down that night. I'm like, wow, this is huge to realize this. But I needed some reassurance that I was right. I reached out to Dr. Greenberg. He's always good about replying to emails. He'll even tell you, I know I haven't replied to you. I'll be back with you in a minute. But I told him my experience and he said, yeah, it sounds like you're ruminating about ruminating. And I wanted to establish therapy with him. Alabama is a psych pack state, but I think wherever he is, isn't. So he couldn't do it, but he connected me with a colleague or somebody he recommended. And we started therapy and it was rocky a little bit in the beginning. I felt like I knew what she was saying, but you know, I was just constantly, what does not engaging with the thought look like? And how do I know I'm directing attention? Like, what does that look like? And what does that feel like? I would just rip it apart. And I got in theory what she was talking about. But what she started really working with me was psychoanalysis. And I do feel psychoanalysis is a helpful part. You know, all of these things in the OCD community and treatment all work together. You know, I don't believe it's a cookie, you know, you should ever use a cookie cutter approach, but you got to figure out what works for the client and what their problem is. But the psychoanalysis was cool because it helped me go back to my origins helps me realize what's happening when these relapses have happened. I'm usually in a turmoil. And I'm usually, and I've heard guests on, you know, like a professional guest on your show talk about OCD being, you're not supposed to feel what you're feeling. You know, you're not allowed, you're not supposed to feel this. And that's pretty center. Usually I'm experiencing some turmoil where I'm experiencing an emotion I don't feel I should be having. So that was helpful, but on some level I knew that I wasn't where I needed to be. And I had already reached out to be on your show. I thought, well, I'd like to be a, you know, member. And I know it, you know, it's like, that's going to take time, right, to before I can actually be on it. But I started listening to your podcast again, and I listened to Sam Greenblatt. He says hi, by the way. Oh, God. But I said, I listened to the episode where he said why, you know, traditional ERP and other therapies don't work for people. I think he spends I liked what he had to say, because I can tell he's, and I know he's very passionate about people like me who have treatment resistant OCD and have failed other therapies. And he said one thing in that episode that I knew I needed to do something about this. He said, if you are scared you're doing therapy wrong, if you're sitting there worried that you're feeling anxious and that shouldn't be happening, because I had thought anxiety was bad, you know, not supposed to feel anxious, I'm not supposed to feel anything. If you are worried you're not doing treatment right, if you don't treat that thing first, nothing you do is going to be successful. And I said, well, he's right. This is exactly what's happened to me for the last 30 something years of my life. Like, I immediately reached out to him, and I listened to his, he's been on your show three times. And yeah, he's been on there three times. So I everything he had to say, I was like, okay, now we're getting somewhere with this. Something else he talks about is that there are some people that are so uncomfortable with uncertainty that you will start to feel angry and depressed or whatever emotion, because you're just accepting the bad thing as happening is getting out of certainty, right? Because you're now, okay, well, I am this monster. Well, I am going to be this, you know, I am. And that is still not uncertainty. That is reaching a conclusion. And my brain will want to do that. It'll want to just, okay, well, I am, you know, I would just rather accept that this bad thing is what it is, or I'm, you know, it reached some conclusion. But that very unstable feeling of uncertainty is something that I'm still working on, that I don't do well with. And so I reached out to him. I couldn't believe he was willing to take me on as a client. I said, you're my fourth therapist in a year and a half. And I mean, I see therapists that are very well trained and very well sought out. And he didn't hesitate. He was like, we need to start immediately. And so we did. And that's where I'm at now. And he, you know, the exposures are centered around me, this need to feel like, you know, I'm doing therapy. You know, I have a fear I'm doing it wrong. You know, and he's led me through exposures, which is something I feel like I've needed. I needed a therapist to walk with me through this a minute, you know, do an exposure and watch what I do, ask me what's happening, you know, really walk through this with me. I'd kind of had some of that, but not around this theme, right? It was around the sexual stuff. So this is the theme that I need treated first, you know? And so, you know, his treatments for me are, you know, he doesn't want me to say you're never going to get this right, or you're likely, no, it's, you might not. You may be a unicorn. You may never understand therapy, and you're never, you might not ever get better. Maybe, you know, it may be that you just have something wrong with you that you're not ever gonna, you know, you're never gonna get it. He'll even say things that are triggering for me, like, just bring yourself back to the present moment. Well, that's triggering, because what the hell does that look like? Well, what does that look like? And then I'm going to go through what, if, you know, and he's like, okay, well, you might, you know, maybe you won't ever understand what that means. And maybe that is the key piece to you getting better, that you're, you know, so these are what I'm exposing myself to, and the need to not figure out whether or not I'm doing therapy right, not to mentally review the steps of OCD self-help treatment. I've actually got to refrain from doing all of that. And it's very uncomfortable, you know, being in uncertainty. I know like what Greenberg and them say about, you know, anxiety is bad. And I get if you are fueling anxiety and engaging in rumination, but you're going to feel uncomfortable. And I can tell you this discomfort is awful. And I'm having to learn to sit with it though. And we're doing exposures that are like, you know, 5 minutes, a couple of times a day. And then I can get, you know, he won't let me get obsessed with that. Cause I'm like, well, you know, after 5 minutes, I always think maybe I need to do 5 more minutes. And then I, you know, so sometimes part of the exposure is just the exposure itself, because I never feel like I quite got it right after the 5 minutes. So the challenge is to move on and not go into the 5 minutes. But I know I've talked a lot. I don't know what all questions you have, but there's probably a lot more I could bring up. But
no, that's amazing. Well, thank you for sharing your story and going into so much detail. And, you know, and also, you know, what hasn't worked for you, what has worked for you, and how you've taken bits from different therapists. And obviously you're with Sam now. So it sounds like your work together is really focusing on keeping you in that uncertainty.
Yes, I can feel it. Yes. And working through those feelings.
Yeah, learning. Go for it.
Yeah, because I don't like to feel. It's like I have trouble with feeling. And, you know, even my other therapist before him realized that it could be about anything. I just have trouble feeling anything that feels not right to me, you know, about anything. But this really trying to keep me in the gray zone, in the uncertain zone, and, you know, not giving into my brain's need to either make sure I'm doing it right, or, you know, to achieve, like, say things like, well, I probably am just doing this wrong. I'm probably, you know, no, trying not to go to that extreme too, and really sit in this. Yeah. That's what he's working with me about right now. And we're doing, you know, we're meeting twice weekly, which, you know, is expensive. You know, Lord, I've spent so much money. A lot of money and time invested in it. And I don't think any of it, I don't regret a dime of it. I mean, I've gained something from every therapist I've been to. And I realize there is no bad or right or wrong, you know, because I'm a very black and white. I think most of us OCDers are black and white, or at least I am. It's all or nothing. You know, well, if ERP didn't work, then ERP is bad, or if ACD, you know, and I'm realizing, you know, I'm trying to come to grips with, you know, even Dr. Greenberg. I mean, there was a time where he was the, you know, grand all, he's got it all, you know, and I think he's great. And I recommend anybody, you know, reviewing his articles and his work, but even I was taking his advice and the tactics and the techniques to an unhealthy level, you know, and using yet trying, you know, Sam Greenblatt realized I was doing was I would even make sure that the thought was vague and blurry, and making sure it was kind of an awareness hovering, but not, you know, so I would even make sure I was monitoring this monitoring I do all the time. And he's like, that's compulsive. Cause I would say, okay, it's not real clear to me. I know I want to make it more clear. That's a compulsion, but it's good. Okay. It's vague. It's blurry. And he's like, yeah, but that sounds compulsive to me. You're reassuring yourself that you're doing the right thing, you know? So even having to give up on that. And he of course has me right now, you know, not journaling. I do compulsively journal. I think journaling is very good. If you can do it a set time every day, let's say, you know, say at night at a certain time and give yourself a certain amount of time. But I'm one of these people who will compulsively journal throughout the day. Aha moments, moments of clarity, or trying to figure out what the thought is. And so, you know, I've stopped doing that. He wants me getting away from all self-help material, going on Instagram, on people's pages. So, you know, we have taken away those compulsions too, as well as.
Did he tell you to stop listening to my show? Right. I'm gonna email it.
I've almost listened to all of them. So, and I've listened to some episodes many times. So for now, he said, just for now, while we're trying to get through this, he didn't say forever, because I love your podcast. And I just think it's such a good thing for the OCD community. I think you've really done something for us, you know, and given us a platform. People, a platform, a voice. We're not alone. Then you've got all the you know, the people, the trained professionals and advocates and people trying to do stuff for the. So, I mean, it's a wonderful thing. But yes, for the time being, I've got to refrain. But
I'll let him off. No, but that's a common thing I hear people say, oh, my therapist told me to stop listening. And I fully get it. part of me, it's annoying, but part of me is like, I get it. The goal of this podcast is to help people. If that means helping him is not listening to it, that's awesome. So with the getting therapy right, has Sam woven, it sounds like he has, but has he verbally woven that into ERP at all? I mean, I don't know how this would be done, just being off the top of my head, but like almost telling you in a way to kind of trigger you, or you've done that wrong or anything like that.
Or you might have done that wrong.
Okay, yeah.
Maybe, because he doesn't want me to say I have, because then my brain's going to shift back to the other and think, right. Well, then, but what if I am doing it right? You know, because just like Greenberg says, rumination is, you know, what if I believe the wrong thing and it's right? Or what if I don't believe it and it's wrong? You know, you're going from one extreme to the other. And so we're trying to sit with uncertainty. So yes, he'll just say things like for instance, if I got triggered the other day when he said, just bring yourself when you notice that you are beginning to put energy and, you know, ruminate. He doesn't use the word ruminate, but when I start analyzing, reasoning, you know, trying to make sure I'm doing therapy right, bring yourself back to the present moment. And I was like, oh my God, that's such a triggering thought, you know, because then that leads me down to make sure I'm doing that right. And he might say, you might never figure that phrase out. That could be the one key piece of information that, you know, because maybe you're not ever going to understand that. And, you know, you might not ever get better. And you could do therapy wrong. And saying these things, you know, the response prevention is, of course, to sit there with those feelings and not try to start analytical thinking, because analytical thinking, you're doing something and it takes that icky discomfort away. For me, it does. Mm. And so, you know, it's just to really sit back and do, I hate to say, but be mindful. You're really sitting there, you know, watching thoughts happen without doing anything about the thought. And one of my compulsions is to understand, well, what was that thought? What exactly did it say? What was the warning? You know, trying to not engage with that. And I've actually had some OCD thoughts about, well, is that right? How do I know that's right? What if I need to read the thought or like read the text message before replying to it? You know, I had to deal with that the other day and just sit back and not regurgitate, you know, like Dr. Greenberg's thing about, you know, he's big on not doing that. And I firmly believe in that too, because it's compulsive. It's compulsive. But then I had this thing, well, what if he's wrong? And I've even had, the other day I even had a thought, well, what if Sam Greenblatt's wrong? And what if he's not right? What if he's doing all this to me and it's the wrong thing? So yeah, the response prevention piece is just to sit there with and keep myself in the uncertainty. And I have a lot of thoughts are popping up, and not trying to do anything about those thoughts popping up is very, very challenging. And, you know, I'm sure, you know, sometimes with mental compulsions, and he said that this happens, we almost automatically start compulsing. He said, it's okay, because I'll beat myself up over that. He said, the minute you realize it and you're aware of it. But sometimes, you know how that happens. I mean, I've heard other people say it's like it's such an ingrained pathway that it happens before I even realize I'm doing it, you know, and then I'll get a little frustrated. And then we have to work on not, you know, getting actively mad and active, not being the participant. You're really working on, he calls it being he says in ACT, there's this thing about being the chessboard and not being the chess pieces, that are not being the person playing. You're not a player. You're not using strategy. You're not, you know, I don't know that I have that right. And that's been my latest exposure, is not to Google that and look at that. Because I don't know that I understand. I think on some level, I get what he's saying. The chessboard is just watching everything, not doing anything. And so, I had to work on that last night, because I was like, oh my God, I don't know that I quite understood what he meant by that. And so an exposure like today would probably be, you know, sitting with that uncertainty that I may not know what that is. And maybe that's something that, it, you know, by not understanding it, I might not ever get better. I might not ever get well. It's very scary to feel that this disease makes things feel so real. That, you know, anything, it can be harm, it can be sex, but it feels real in that moment. And that's horrifying, especially with the sexually based thoughts, because it really feels like, oh my God, it just feels so real. And then with this, it really feels like I'm doing something wrong. Anything could be wrong. Any of these thoughts, so many thoughts are popping up. Like I call them pop-up ads. They're just pop-ups. Yeah. They're just constantly. And that feels so wrong. You know, it's like this, golly, is this supposed to be happening? And trying not to figure that out. Or because the minute I start analytical thinking and reasoning, that's compulsive, or anything that's avoiding the uncertainty, anything I do is in avoiding that. So, yeah, we're working on that. And it's making me confront a lot of very uncomfortable feelings I've been avoiding for a very long time.
Yeah, that's it. So, yeah, so in ACT, ACT, they're big on the term experiential avoidance, which is what most people with OCD do, including myself, of I avoid this experience because I don't want it, the experience being the thoughts or the feelings or both. And here it sounds like you're starting to make space for those feelings. You don't love them, but you're kind of welcoming them in as just thoughts and feelings, just an experience, not as facts or anything like that. And that's scary, but that's ultimately how we get rid of them. Or lessen them, again, no certainty in that, but
no, there's not. That's the problem. That's where the discomfort comes from.
Yeah.
And you're right. You're so right that, the avoidance of this experience, whatever this is, this discomfort and need for this to go away, I cannot tell you, how much I didn't realize I was avoiding this uncomfortable feeling. It's, I don't know how to describe it. I describe it as, I don't think it's anxiety as the term is, but it certainly feels restless, unstable, unsafe. Mm-hmm. It feels like there is, there's a big warning going on and you're not like you're in your house and you hear somebody breaking in it and you're not allowed to go protect yourself.
Yeah.
It kind of feels like that to me.
Yeah, that's kind of how I talk about it with my clients, of like that part of your brain that's triggered in that uncertainty. It can't tell the difference. It doesn't know what you're actually worried about. It just feels you're at risk. So there's no difference between a tiger being in front of you and you worrying maybe you sexually assaulted someone, for example. To that part of your brain, it's as real as the tiger, whether there is a tiger in front of you or not. So that's why it's so hard. It's terrifying because you're effectively having to sit with the same anxiety you would in front of a tiger, but you want to react, you want to do a compulsion because it's very, very uncomfortable.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. That's exactly it. I mean, it's like how this feels so wrong. That's my problem. This feels so wrong to not do anything about, these multitude of thoughts that are coming in that this could be wrong or whatever, or this isn't right. And then wanting to argue back, want to engage in an argument with, OCD and refute it and try to, or either just go through therapy in my head, like the chessboard thing. Okay. He was, trying to, what did he mean by that? That's compulsive for me. I can't keep doing that because once is never enough. I could Google search it. I know on some level that I could go buy a book or go find a podcast or go look it up online and figure out, get it just right. And that's not going to last. And it's going to make me worse, Yeah. I mean, so this is really a difficult theme, but I'm hopeful that this is what I've needed this whole time. Mm-hmm. This is the missing, that little missing piece. I needed to be working on this theme first. And of course, I'm still having sexual intrusive thoughts. I don't like them, they're just what they are. I mean, I just sit with the awful discomfort that they bring on, And I feel like as I work on this theme, I mean, I'm not sure, I guess either that's going to take care of the sexual intrusive thoughts on its own, just what I've learned by doing this ERP, or we may end up doing some exposures to that. I've done lots of exposures to that. And I know one thing I discovered, because even when I was with my therapist before Sam Greenblatt, I kept telling her, because, you know, she wasn't big on ERP, you know, or she wasn't big on me really doing it in that fashion. She just wanted to work on the not ruminating part, the response prevention part, which is the key piece. But I kept saying, you know, I mean, I need something concrete, you know, for my brain. I just need something tangible. And she was fine. She said, you know, just use spontaneous triggers, because every time I exposed myself to the sexual thoughts, it never felt right or scary enough. And she goes, I think it's because, you know, you're bringing it up. Mm. And she's right. I think that's why I never could get the satisfaction from it. She said, why don't you, if you're ever in a place where you can do some exposure response, when you are spontaneously triggered in that moment, just let yourself feel whatever it is you're feeling. And I did do an exposure not long ago, right before I started with Sam Greenblatt. And I realized when I really just relaxed and was doing it, I started feeling the groinal again. I had really let myself and my guard down. And I thought, oh my God, you know, that is what is bothering me. I am tensing and wincing and doing all this stuff to not feel arousal. That was a pretty pivotal moment, because I realized that, again, you know, analytical thinking and getting out of uncertainty is kind of stopping this spontaneous feeling from arising. And I had been working on that a little bit prior to starting with Sam. So we may get there, but I've already discovered, you know, when I do have an intrusive unwanted sexual thought, to just take, you know, just to try to relax and kind of let the feelings be there, which I don't like, but.
Of course. Yeah, you got to like ride out the urge, because it will urge being, and not in a sexual sense, but urges in whether that's urge for like to do a compulsion or whatever it is. If we sit with it long enough, it's like a wave, it will crash and go. But if, you know, if we do a, otherwise we end up doing like a compulsion, checking groin or something like that at that peak, and we don't ever see that actually the urge comes down. And that's the tough bit, but that's where the recovery is, you know?
Yeah, no, it is. And, you know, and also for people like me and Chrissy Hodges, actually, one of her recent videos was about this, because she and I still get peer support from her a good bit. And, you know, another thing that people with sexual-based intrusive thoughts can do, which can be very disturbing, is when you're sitting with the groinal and the arousal, is the urge to make it go away through masturbation. And that is something I don't think is talked about a lot, because these are really embarrassing things to talk about.
Yeah.
But she and I talked about it. She goes, yes, that's compulsive too, because, and just like Greenblatt said, it's a way of getting the feeling over with, or just saying, Lindy, I just want to get out of feeling like this. Because if I make the orgasm happen, then it didn't happen spontaneously, you know, because if I did it, of course I would think about something totally beyond, you know, what my intrusive thoughts are. But it's that need of wanting that to even go away, of not even letting that dissipate. And I think if I could ever do an exposure where I really sit with it, and because usually I just always end up abandoning the exposure with that, because I'm so distressed by the groin.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, yeah. And I did it. I had tried it a little bit, and it did. If I don't start going crazy about, oh my God, should I do something with this arousal? You know, it feels like you said, it's not giving in to an urge, whatever that urge is. That's the discomfort. I think that's the crux of everything, is resisting urges. You know, that's what I avoid, you know, it's and even in my own life, I have a lot of urges that happen throughout the day. A lot of them are around inappropriate eating. I mean, if I get hit with wanting to eat something, oh my God, until I eat just a bite of it, it will not leave me alone. I remember even my therapist before Sam was actually started working with me on that, because it is distressing for me. I guess it's a form of OCD. But I have to really give myself, you know, like, okay, I'm going to eat 3 meals a day. I'm not going to, because if I ever start snacking, it sets off this snacking thing. And so I get very distressed when I don't want to be eating and I get the urge to go eat something. Like during the holidays when everybody's bringing food, I think I've got to eat a bite of everything. Like that's a compulsive urge. I know it is. When people bring stuff, I can't just be okay with saying, okay, I'm going to try the peanut butter cookie. No, if somebody brought cupcakes and chocolate chip and fudge, and I want to try every one of them. But yeah, I deal with a lot of other urges, you know, that are OCD in some nature, but.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's interesting. So let's try and look at my questions. I think you've answered a million of them, which is awesome. Let's just go with, you know, your journey's been had lots of twists and turns, and you've learned a heck of a lot along the way. So what words of hope would you give someone listening with OCD?
And what words of hope is, if anyone can relate to my story, there's hope. Mm. You know, words of hope is, it's okay if your therapist isn't helping you. If you feel your therapist, because, you know, I didn't believe therapists could be wrong. I didn't believe that they could be wrong. And so something was always wrong with me. But, you know, for anyone out there who's in treatment and you feel like you are getting worse, you are. I mean, I'm serious. If you know that this disease, we all know what the disease feels like. We all know when things are worse. You know, I would say, listen to your gut, talk to your therapist about it, you know, seek treatment elsewhere, but don't continue in therapy, especially if you're having to pray privately, like I've had to do, you know, if you don't feel like you're getting the results. And I think Greenblatt talks about this. You need measurable. There needs to be your goals obtainable. You know, you need to be seeing results. And if you're not getting that, don't be afraid to speak up, you know?
Yeah.
I guess, you know, I don't know if those are words of hope or not. I guess they're words of encouragement, or just to be courageous and be an advocate for yourself. You know, I could think of so many different things, but that, I guess that's the main thing, is that for me and this long journey I've been on, you know, it took me a long time. And your podcast was part of that. I think your podcast is, I know I'm having to take a break from it, but that's not going to last forever. But I do think if someone is still in that space, that there's so much hope in that podcast, and there's so much information and listening to the OCD stories that, you know, just keep listening. Things, light bulbs will go off. You will, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, ideally, I'd love for you never to need to listen to my podcast again, you know, that's.
Well, something one of my therapists, when I was doing it, because I worried that I was addicted, but you know what I mean? I was using OCD self-help. And he said, well, as long as you're not thinking, oh my God, I got to go listen to it now or compulsively, he would say, set aside a time. Yeah. Let's say I'm going to do it. That way you're a planned time. And I think if I ever do, because I want to be, I still have goals of maybe I'll be a therapist one day. Maybe I'll be an advocate, or I want to do something for the OCD community. And I'm still reasoning that out. I want to get to a better place in my recovery first. But if I go back, it won't be in a compulsive manner. It would be, I'll set aside.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Good. And I like what you said about changing therapists if you need to. Like, you know, for me, my goal as a therapist is to help people. And if my clients don't feel I'm helping them, I want them to fire me, you know? I'm going to be a bit upset, obviously, but ultimately I want what's best for them. And if I feel that they need to go somewhere else, then that's fine by me.
And I think that goes more for the therapist. If you feel like you're not helping a person, get a sense that this person is just, I'm missing something here. Explore it with them. If you've got questions, you know, I feel like I've been through a lot of therapy. Even before these last 2 years, I had therapists. And sometimes they were just dead set that their way was going to be the way, you know, there's a very cookie cutter. Well, we've got to do it this way. And not everybody's going to respond to that cookie cutter approach. So I think a good therapist is able to recognize that all people are different and have different needs.
You know? Yeah. It's spot on. Absolutely. Okay. And then, okay. So, you know, your 20-year-old self, like you said, you already had two young boys, building your own home, running a successful career, or starting building that. What would you tell that 20-year-old version of you?
I've been thinking about this, and I journaled a lot. Yes, I did it compulsively, and I would tell anybody journaling is great, but you need to set aside time to do it and not do it compulsively. But I want to tell her, she's going to go through a hard time again, and she's going to journal a lot. And I would tell her, I would say, thank you so much. I want to go ahead and tell you, please journal away. because the 48-year-old you is reading those journals now. And I'm like, right now, I've got to stop reading my journals. That's part of my therapy. But I had just found my journals from years ago, and they've been so amazing to read. Oh my gosh, it's just amazing to me to go back and read my little 20-year-old self. And I would want to let her know that she's smart, and she's as smart as she thinks she is. And she's powerful and bright and intelligent, and she can do anything she wants. But I just want to let her know to journal away. Just you're going to start some journaling, and I just thank you for that in advance. Nice. I don't know if that makes any sense.
It does. Yeah, I like it. And then let's say you've got a billboard in, let's say, Birmingham, Alabama.
Or yeah.
Birmingham, as you would
call it. Birmingham.
Birmingham, what you say. What would you want written on that billboard?
You know, I thought about this. This might be kind of odd, but I love Jeffrey Schwartz's phrase, reality doesn't mimic OCD feelings. Mm-hmm. I always like that. You know, I can scrub, you know, pick it apart, but, you know, he says reality doesn't mimic OCD feelings. I always like that.
Yeah. Do you think you could pick it apart? I think I'm a tiny bit lost with it. I think I get it, but if you could expand it.
He said that, you know, when you read, if you've ever, like I said, I read Brain Lock to a point that back in 1998, I had it memorized. He's saying that because OCD feels so real, it feels so real in that moment, but reality, what's really happening, doesn't mimic. In other words, what's really happening is not happening. It's not. Mm. It's not what it feels like. It feels real, but it's not.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. Like, in other words, you don't have to. The way he uses it in the book is you don't have to give in to what your brain is asking you to do. His big thing is don't do what your OCD is telling you to do. That may be another billboard. Don't do what your OCD is telling you to do. Yeah. Don't give in to whatever it is. But yeah, I don't know. Something's comforting. It's probably compulsive, but there's something that's like reality doesn't mimic these feelings. Hmm. But yeah. or don't do what the OCD is telling you to do.
Well, we can have two. And then lastly, is there anything else you wish you could have said or shared today?
I wrote some things down. I'm making sure that I really think I shared everything I can think of. We've talked about I want to share is that and I think, you know, one of the self-help books I read brought this up. You know, people with OCD, if you're like me, you think there's going to be this magical pill, this magical diet. I know the sun's in my eyes. This magical way of life, whether it be, okay, I'll be the perfect Christian, or I'm going to take the perfect supplement, or I'm going to get my hormones right of balance. You know, all of that stuff's not going to make your OCD go away. And I'm living proof of that. You know, and it's like, yeah, you know, medications, they help a lot of people, but I think they're just like Jeffrey Schwartz talks about, their water wings. You know, they're just kind of, they kind of help you get over the anxiety. And I think medications are very helpful, and I've even thought about using them again. But I guess for not outside of real medications, just, you know, natural treatments or, you know, all of this other stuff, be careful with that, because you'll be watching for it to make you better and you'll think it's made you worse. You know, one thing I would like to tell people out there, one substance that I do avoid now and I'm very careful with is alcohol. And I have noticed an intense worsening of my symptoms after a night of heavy drinking. Mm-hmm. And I have reduced my alcohol intake almost entirely. And when I do drink, I try to drink very moderately. I think I've heard there is a lot. I think there's some evidence out there to support that. It just makes the hangover just makes the symptoms a lot worse. So I would tell anybody out there, you know, to be mindful of that.
Yeah, good point. Well, alcohol is still a drug. Just because it's legal, it's still a drug, you know, and it still affects us. And obviously it's going to affect people differently. Some people are probably fine.
True. Some people may, yeah.
Okay. So, look, thank you so much for sharing your story. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate you having me on. I've looked forward to this day for a long time. So it's an honor. It's an honor. And maybe I'll be back on it someday. Who knows?
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe as a therapist. Who knows?
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you enjoy the OCD Stories podcast and would like to support us with a one-time tip/donation, please go to theocdstories.com/support. All tips, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to the podcast. And thank you to NoCD for supporting our work. If you want to find out more about NoCD, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or click the link in the episode description. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.